Senator Mansfield, President Nixon has announced this morning that he is sending General Alexander Haig to Saigon. Does that give you any indication of the success or failure of this latest round of Paris peace talks?
Oh, it's an indication that they're getting somewhere, although I don't see why they have to go to Saigon to consult with Tu, when after all, the president, by a stroke of the pen, can bring this war to a close.
From CBS Washington, Face the Nation, a spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Mike Mansfield, Democrat of Montana. Senator Mansfield will be questioned by CBS News congressional correspondent Roger Mudd, Shirley Elder of the Washington Star News, and CBS News correspondent George Herman.
Senator Mansfield, you've said that the president could end the war in Vietnam by a stroke of the pen, and last week, the outgoing Secretary of Defense, Melvin Laird, said that Vietnamization has succeeded, the Vietnamese could carry on by themselves. But Secretary Richardson, who's to be the new Secretary of Defense, says that we will not have an agreement until there is peace in the area. It is not enough just to have Vietnamization. So do you think the president will use that stroke of the pen?
It's up to him. I understand Mr. Kissinger came back saying that the decision was up to the president, so we'll wait and see what happens. No details have been forthcoming.
Have you been in any kind of communication with the White House
None at
in
all.
The last 24 hours?
None at all.
Senator, why shouldn't the United States send General Haig to Saigon to brief General Tu on what's going on?
Well, frankly, I am interested in the settlement of this war. The return of our POWs, our recoverable missing in action. I think we've paid too high a price already for a mistake which never should have occurred. And it's about time that this matter was brought to a close. And I think that Dr. Kissinger has endeavored to do that. And I feel, don't know, that the president is considering that most seriously at the present time based on Kissinger's report.
Well, do you mean that that in the past instance last fall that it was our consultation with President Tu in Saigon that resulted in the tentative agreement being abrogated?
I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised, but that Tu had a part to play in it.
Do you think that the matter would be, as you put it, closed if there were still war between North and South Vietnam?
Well, I think that's perhaps inevitable. It may take some time, but if we go back to the Geneva Accords, which supposedly were agreed to last October, it means that in time the line of demarcation would be subject to an all-Vietnamese election. And it was my understanding then, and I believe what Mr. Kissinger had to say, that we were returning, in that instance at least, and in other aspects as well, to the 1954 Geneva Accords.
If this is another false start, is there anything that Congress can and should do?
Not really. We can pass resolutions, but we can't end the war. It's really up to the president. We shouldn't fool ourselves in that respect. We can cut off funds. Whether or not a majority of the Senate or a majority of the Congress would do it, I don't know. If they did, it could be overturned, vetoed, and that veto probably could not be overridden. As far as I'm concerned, I have not voted for funds for Southeast Asia for the last 3 years. I don't intend to vote for them this year if the war is going on.
But if you say that we shouldn't fool ourselves, Senator, about Congress's ability to end the war, why have you passed so many resolutions, and why is the Mansfield Amendment pushed each Congress to?
Well, the reason is to indicate to the executive branch of the government, the president, that what the feeling and the intent of the Congress is.
But you weren't fooling yourself by passing the Mansfield resolution?
No, I was trying to do everything I possibly could to help to bring about the ending to this war, and the only weapon left which the Congress has is the control of the purse.
Will it be exercised? Will the Congress stand together? Does the Congress feel strongly enough to stand together and exercise the control of the purse?
It feels much stronger this year. Frankly, I doubt that it would stand together. As far as I'm concerned, I intend to vote against appropriations for Southeast Asia.
Well, now, why won't it stand together? Is it because some members of Congress support the war in Vietnam, or is it because they do not support the idea of going against the President of the United States?
The latter, I think. I don't know of any member who really supports the war in Vietnam at this time, but it's a question of supporting the President, giving him as much flexibility as possible. They have a point of view, and hoping that in some way an agreement will be arrived at.
Well, now, you said in your speech to the Democratic caucus that Congress bears some of the responsibility for
this
war.
We do indeed.
Is that a negative responsibility, that you bear it by not having acted earlier?
That is correct. I think we were lacking in our responsibility and our application to duty. We allowed things to get out of hand. And this creeping war, this mistaken war, finally was enlarged, where at one time we had 546,000 men. I'd like to see this war ended. And as far as the area is concerned, I'd like to see it cover all of Indochina. I think that as far as Laos and Cambodia go, they can maintain their independence in Laos under the leadership of the King Savang Vatanah, and I think that in Cambodia that Prince Norodom Sihanouk, who is now sojourning in Peking, ought to be returned because he's the only one who can bring stability to that country.
But to get back to the American constitutional problem, do you see any prospect that Congress will recover the power to wage war, which is supposed to belong only to Congress?
Yes, but it'll be a gradual process. We've given away a lot of our authority, a lot of our responsibility under the Constitution. I don't blame the executive branch for it. I blame the Congress because what we've done voluntarily, perhaps unknowingly in some respects, but we've done it. We've got to try and bring about a restoration of those powers. We made a start last year. We'll continue this year. It's easy to give, it's hard to take back, but we'll keep trying.
How does that happen, Senator, that a third branch of government, the Congress, gives away its powers?
Well, since the time of Franklin D. Roosevelt, on occasions we've bowed to the executive, and in so doing we've allowed the transference of some of our powers under the Constitution to the executive branch.
But, I mean, why do you bow? Is it just easier to bow than to fight the president?
Easier in some instances, not knowing the full facts and details in others. A number of factors have to be considered.
Now, in the precise instance about administration witnesses coming before congressional committees, your Senate Democratic Caucus passed a resolution, adopted a resolution last week, that pledged your committee chairman and committees to try to get from the nominees a commitment to return to the Hill and testify. You said after it was over that it didn't have really many teeth in it.
That's right, but I...
Well, what good does it do to threaten the administration with...
We're not threatening. I'm not threatening the administration. All we're doing is reasserting our constitutional rights under the advice and consent clause of the Constitution, and I have no doubt but that they'll all appear.
But you're just reasserting those rights on paper without any way to get the rights back, aren't you?
Oh, not just on paper, because you have the unanimous support of the Democratic caucus, and I think the Republicans, by and large, will come along, because, after all, this is a Senate matter, this is a constitutional matter, this is our prerogative.
But do you really believe, Senator, that if, say, Earl Butz or Mr. Lynn or Caspar Weinberger refuse to deliver a pledge to return to Capitol Hill every time a duly constituted committee of the Senate wants him back, that you will withhold it?
If they're a cabinet officer, they'll come back. If they're in the position of counselors, that's the question the policy committee will go into next week, the question of executive privilege, and we'll thresh that out then, one step at a time. About this one, there's no question. Executive privilege is in the gray area. We'll come up with something to try and take care of that.
But you still have not gotten Secretary Rogers to come before the Senate Foreign Rights
Committee. He hasn't been asked since this resolution was passed, and besides, we're in a new Congress.
But if just following the caucus and the feeling around the Hill when you came back last week was that we're not going to permit any more of this erosion of power by the executive. Now you came right up to the point of threatening to withhold confirmation. But then you couldn't carry through on it.
No, don't put words in my mouth, Mr. Mudd. What you are saying is what you are saying, not what I've said.
Well, all your colleagues are saying that we're going to withhold confirmation if these guys don't promise
to
return.
No, one or two have indicated that, but not the great majority. So I would hope that the facts could be kept straight.
Well, then what's the purpose of the resolution?
To reassert our constitutional prerogative.
And you have, and you've got those prerogatives back now.
No, we've always had them, but we've allowed them to lapse, and I anticipate without question that there will be no question about presidential appointees for cabinet positions and the like appearing before the Congress when requested.
Let me go back to the make war ability of the Congress. President Eisenhower in Lebanon, President Truman in Korea, presidents without number in South Vietnam. How can the Congress stop them? Do you need an amendment to the Constitution which will say that no president can take any action without the Congress? And would that be good or bad for the country?
Well, we have to recognize that in a nuclear age, there may be occasions when the president has to act almost instantaneously. But I think we better reassert the power of the Congress under the Constitution, which gives us the authority to declare war. And I think that from now on, these resolutions which are sent up by the presidents of either party will be given the most serious consideration, and that as time goes on, the power to declare war will be and should be restored.
But how do you stop it? Supposing some future president decides to send a few troops to protect American citizens in no matter what country. How does the Congress stop it? How do you stop the beginning of a South Vietnam?
Raise the questions at the beginning and refuse the funds. And I would point out that that's what Senator Stennis and Senator Russell of Georgia both tried to do. That is, raise the question, express their opposition before action was taken in Vietnam, for instance.
But when you talk of congressional erosion of power, you're talking about today and a situation that exists. One member of the House has described the Congress as a limp bunch of pumpkins. Do you think there really is the will to fight this sort of thing now in the Congress?
Well, Miss Elder, let me say that the words have been spoken in the Democratic caucus, at least. Now we'll see whether the Senate will get behind the leadership and do what they said they were willing, that they were in favor of at the time of the caucuses which have been held. So the words are there. Let's see if the substance is forthcoming. It's not up to the leadership, it's up to the Senate as a whole.
But the leadership does have a role. You, as one of the leaders of the Congress, meet from time to time with the President of the United States. You've met with Mr. Nixon in the White House. Do you tell him what you think, what the Congress thinks, and what you feel must be done for the good of the country?
I did at our last meeting.
What did you tell him, sir?
I told him what the situation was relative to the bombing and Southeast Asia, Vietnam specifically, and made him aware of the feelings of the Democrats up there and what I thought was the feelings of a number of, were the feelings of a number of Republicans as well.
Did you make him aware of what might happen if he persisted in this course?
No, that wasn't necessary because he is a politically smart individual. He has served in the House and Senate. I served with him in both bodies, and he had the facts, and that was enough.
Senator, how much consultation do you think a president owes to Congress?
That's up to the president, but I would say this, that the president has indicated he's going to have more in the way of bipartisan meetings of the leadership in this coming year, along with his regular Republican leadership meetings. And I have an idea after this thing shakes down that there may be more consultation between the president and the Congress. I would assume, I don't know, and that if there's any kind of a break in the in Southeast Asia, vis-a-vis the agreements, and they are not too delicate that he might well call in the leadership.
I take it from your answer you don't think there has been enough consultation in the past with Mr. Nixon.
I don't, but speaking generally, but as far as I'm concerned personally, there has been.
Do I understand you to say that you think that if the Vietnam War should be out of the picture, that relations between the President and the Congress would be much closer, that you would work more closely together?
I think they would be better. This is not in the form of a threat, which
no, sir, I didn't mean that way.
It would be much better because the war in Southeast Asia is a cancer on the soul of America. It's caused so much in the way of divisions at home. It's diverted so much in the way of funds, $140 billion roughly. It's caused almost 360,000 casualties, of which 45,000 plus was killed in combat. And it has been something which has to be done away with, which must be ended as soon as possible. We must get out, OUT, all the way from Southeast Asia, and I would include Thailand in that as well, and get back to the problems which are of immediate import and interest to us, and do what we can in this world, and not on a world policeman basis, but on the basis of our limited manpower and our limited resources.
But the war is not the only source of conflict between the Congress of the United States and the President. For example,
no.
You have the question of withheld funds, which
That's
you're now
right.
pressing in the third branch of government, the courts.
But the war is the most important and the most immediate. And as far as the impoundment of funds are concerned, that matter will be gone into, and I anticipate that Senator Irvin's subcommittee will go into that in great detail. There we find much unity among Democrats and Republicans about this usurpation of power on the part of the executive of what the Congress has done and a flaunting of the congressional intent.
Senator, have you found that the opening mood of the 93rd Congress is unusually acrimonious, or is that mainly political rhetoric?
I wouldn't use the word acrimonious. I would say disturbed, frustrated, uneasy.
You attribute most of that to the war, or do you have other factors in mind?
Mostly to the war. The impoundment factor comes in, the shifting of of responsibilities, a number of factors, but Vietnam, Southeast Asia, one.
Do you think the president and his liaison men to the Hill have been adept or inept?
I'd say that as far as his liaison man to the Senate, Tom Corologos, is concerned, he's been exceptionally cooperative and accommodating and has done a first-rate job, and I think that every senator would back up that statement.
But generally, have congressional relations as conducted from the White House been superior or inferior?
I think they could be improved.
You used the word consultation when you were talking of the meetings between the congressional leadership and the White House. Did you feel, for instance, this most recent breakfast meeting a couple of Fridays ago fell into the area of consultation? Did that satisfy
No.
you?
No, but the president called about 25 or 30 members of the Congress down to discuss the reorganization of the White House, the creation of three new positions as counselors, to discuss wage and price control legislation, and then in the last 10 minutes, on his own, he discussed the situation in Vietnam and Southeast Asia on a rather brief basis, and then he left. But then he had said ahead of time that he wanted to get us out of there to attend the funeral, the services of Harry Truman at the cathedral.
But was there any exchange in the rest of the meeting between
yes.
the congressman and the...
There was indeed. Not on Vietnam, because the president left at the conclusion of his remarks, but on the three counselors to be newly created, and on wage and price legislation, yes. Considerable.
Let me take you back to the impounded funds for a moment. It's all very well to say the president has usurped authority and that he's done what he shouldn't have done and that violates the Constitution and so forth. But when the Congress appropriates and authorizes and insists on the spending of more money than we're taking in, this can be extremely unhappy for the economy. We've been in a boom period. We've been fighting inflation. It's all very well to say the president shouldn't do it, but will Congress discipline itself and stop spending more than we can afford?
A good point, because the president tried to have that power transferred to him, the constitutional power of the Congress to tax and to appropriate last year, to appropriate primarily, although the tax factor has to be considered. He did succeed in the House, not in the Senate, but he awakened the Congress to its responsibility, and the result is that we have a joint committee on the budget to look into that matter, and I have advocated to the committee chairman and to the members of this joint committee that I think it's our responsibility to create a spending budget and to live within it, and it is not the president's responsibility.
Will it happen?
Well, if it doesn't happen, then he's going to ask for that authority again. Once we give it to him, it's going to be temporary. In time, it's going to be permanent, and we're going to lose another one of our constitutional responsibilities.
All this comes right now at a time when the president has ended Phase 2 controls, and we're now in a Phase 3 of...
Well, I'm not so certain that was a good move, because the president, or at least the statement put out at the time that Phase 3 was gone into, indicated how good the last year and 3 months had been, that inflation had been reduced from 6.2, I believe, to about 3.4, and here we are taking off controls at a time which we ought to leave them on. I'm afraid, and I hope I'm wrong, and that despite all the good words and the promises of strong action, if there are deviations from Phase 3, that it might encourage the inflationary situation once more. And at the present time, our inflation percentage is about 3.4, as I've indicated, about 6.1% in Japan. It's around that figure in all of Western Europe. And I hate to see a situation which has stabilized itself be shifted and thereby create the possibility of a change upward, inflationary speaking. And look at what's happened to the wholesale price index.
This is the George Aiken principle, isn't it? You just declare victory and then stop fighting.
On the
inflation,
home front?
On inflation.
No, keep the same program in effect.
No, I mean the administration's policy has just been to pull out, hasn't it?
Yeah, but it's being used in reverse. George Aiken really had a splendid idea as far as the war in Vietnam was concerned 4 or 5 years ago. And they, like the fellow who sat down to play at the piano, they laughed at him then. But now, more and more, they're beginning to recognize that George Aiken, that wise owl, knew what he was talking about and made a good suggestion then, which we didn't have sense enough to take up, or at least the administration at that time, a Democratic administration, may I say.
But on Phase 2, Phase 3, you advocate retaining controls.
Yes,
is that
indeed.
Correct?
Yes, indeed.
Here again, is there something Congress can do Do you think that the Congress ought to pass new control legislation?
Oh, I think we'll pass control legislation, but you know we did before, Miss Elder, and for 2 or 3 years the President was unalterably opposed to wage and price controls as passed by the Congress, but when the crunch came, he shifted 180 degrees and put them into effect because he had no choice. The dollar was on the point of becoming a disaster currency.
Well, now with controls at least partially off, fiscal and monetary policy becomes more and more important, and we come back to the fact, will the Congress hold down on the spending?
As far as I'm concerned, we're going to make every effort to do that. We're going to try and establish a spending ceiling and live within it. I think it's mandatory that the Congress do it, and I will make every effort to see that it does. However, it's going to be up to the Congress.
Am I free to bring up the question of seniority?
Anything.
All right.
So long as it's not between us.
Do you foresee, Senator, any major change in the seniority system?
No, as far as the Senator's concerned, I don't see any need for any.
You do not?
No.
Well, then why is everyone complaining about it?
That's what I've asked myself many times.
You don't think it could be improved upon, that members should be chosen on merit?
If you think of a better system, well, we'll be glad to consider it, but the chairman, and that's where the chief emphasis is laid, are elected by secret ballot in the Democratic Steering Committee. They are elected by ballot in the Democratic Conference, and anybody who objects to those elections can raise the point. And they are elected singly in the Senate, and anyone who wants to object there can do so. I think that this idea of seniority, as far as the Senate is concerned, has been entirely misinterpreted. We have a good democratic system.
You shifted there. You said a secret ballot in the steering committee.
That's
and then
right.
You said ballot.
That's right.
In the conference.
Any
that means
kind
one
they
is...
want. Secret, open, by roll call vote, voice vote, anything they want. It's up to the conference to decide. It's up to the Senate to decide.
Well, isn't that, if I really were to object to a chairman, wouldn't that be a little embarrassing for me to stand up and be kamikaze and ask for a secret ballot?
Why should it be? Because the chairman is only a senator, and the Senate is made up of 100 members of equal standing, and that includes chairman and members of committee. There are no super senators.
Do you think the present system results in the most meritorious men becoming chairman of committees?
Not always, but on the whole, the system hasn't worked badly, and if they want to change it, they can.
There may not be any super senators at the moment, but at one time or another in the history of the United States Senate, there have been some super senators who've wielded the leadership with a pretty heavy hand. Is this not a good time to change that situation so it's not likely to come back?
No, I don't think so. I think the leader ought to act as he is, not what you would and others would like him to be. And remember, the leader is only one of 100 among his peers. And in many instances, the leader has less power than the other senators because he is the servant of the Senate. And this applies to Hugh Scott as well. Oh, you could crack the whip. I'd never do it. You might gain a victory now and again, but in the long run, you'd lose a lot more than you gain for the moment.
Senator, a couple of years ago, you were on this broadcast, and there were some people carping about your leadership, and they were predicting this would be your last term, and you got so angry that on Face the Nation, you announced that you intended to run again.
Really?
Yes, you remember that. Do you intend to run again in 76?
Oh, I never look ahead, but as far as getting back to George Herman's question is concerned, not evading what you've said, I have been called a weak leader. I have been called a pretty good leader. I would say that I've been a garden variety, just a common, ordinary leader who tries to treat his colleagues on the same basis that he would like his colleagues to treat him.
But are you going to run again in 76?
Well, it's a long time off.
But you said you didn't want to evade my question.
No, and I said it's a long time off, and that's the answer. That's no evasion, because I never make up my mind till just before it's time to do so.
Senator, one of the things which troubled the press and which was written a great deal in the papers and on the air before the election was the Watergate case.
Oh, that's going to be gone into, because Senator Ervin, I met with him last Friday, I believe, or Thursday. And it was an unusual way by means of which Sam Ervin was asked to take over this job, because the Democratic Policy Committee unanimously recommended that he should. The Democratic Conference unanimously recommended that he should. And he has undertaken this obligation. And I wanted to go beyond Watergate. I want these phony letters which were distributed during the Florida primary, affecting Muskie, and Jackson and Humphrey looked into, and there are other matters too, and they were all laid out in the speech which I made to the Democrats at the first caucus meeting.
Senator, we only have about 30 seconds left, but do you think that we're going to get a lengthy and detailed report? Will there be complete investigation? Can it be completely investigated?
You bet there will be.
With what staff? I mean, you don't have your FBI in the Senate.
Oh, no, but then one other thing we want to look into is the dossiers which the FBI and the military agencies have been keeping on members of Congress or candidates for Congress. We're going to look into this very, very thoroughly.
We look forward to it. Thank you very much, Senator Mansfield, for being with us today on Face the Nation.
That's what people tell me. I have no desire to try to score any kind of dope here. I didn't. Most places in Europe, there's the penalties are just too strict, and there's nothing you can do once you get busted.
Well, if I understood the laws a little more, I would have definitely, you know, copped out, because I realized it's just too heavy.
There's no one that can help you.
And everybody says, like, it's not worth it, and it's true.
The laws are very strict, and they enforce them, and if you smoke and you get caught, then you have to be willing to pay the dues.
Well, I still have 5.5 years left, so it's quite a long time before I am free. I can't even see the end of it.
You just say goodbye to it for a while.
There are over 900 United States citizens doing time on drug charges in foreign jails. They didn't know, or they didn't care. When you're busted for drugs over there, you're in for the hassle of your life.
It's been a lot of pain to a lot of people who I know.
Today on Face the Nation, the Senate Democratic leader, Senator Mike Mansfield of Montana, was questioned by CBS News congressional correspondent Roger Mudd, Shirley Elder of the Washington Star News, and CBS News correspondent George Herman. Next week, another prominent figure in the news will face the nation. Face the Nation originated from CBS, Washington.